Bitcoin has the best chance of becoming the global reserve currency.
Bitcoin will be the 50% of every human interaction.
HODL waves, I think, are the most important visualization of the Bitcoin blockchain.
All of a sudden, everybody saves in Bitcoin, whereas like, oh, if I wait 2 months longer and don't get the newest iPhone, or I wait like a year longer before I upgrade my car, this completely changes society.
The largest number of users were with custodians, but the most Bitcoin was in self-custody, and same thing is true today. Most people lose their Bitcoin from just getting their accounts hacked, or their username, their password, two-factor authentication.
Why is Unchained or like yourself Bitcoin-only focused? Or differently ask, do you see all the other cryptos or altcoins as a scam?
That's a really great question. And I might even start before answering it directly. I love to hear that you're based in Europe, because I started my Bitcoin career while I was living in Europe. So my wife and I, we weren't married at the time, but we were living in the Netherlands. So that's where I really left my fiat career in about 2017 and started my career in Bitcoin. So love helping out the Europeans to understand why Bitcoin. Now to your next question, I think it's a very deep question that requires quite a bit of research. So it's my perspective that Bitcoin is the new global reserve currency. That might be a big statement, but the reason I believe that that is true is because Bitcoin has a fixed supply of 21 million, and it is not controlled by any single authority. So all other currencies, fiat, crypto, whatever, they were all founded and created by a central authority. And what's different with Bitcoin is that while it was created by a pseudonymous individual, Satoshi Nakamoto, we don't know who they were. That person left the project very early on, specifically so that they wouldn't be a single point of failure for Bitcoin. So when I think about Bitcoin versus all of the other currencies, the core components that I think are really important are, one, the fixed supply of 21 million. All other currencies don't really have a monetary policy with much credibility. We're seeing just this week with the yen, the third largest currency in the world, that it's being massively devalued and seemingly randomly. With Bitcoin, you have a fixed supply. It's released on a schedule, and regardless of what's happening in the world, that schedule just keeps on chugging along. That's not the only important thing about Bitcoin, but I think it's where like all the value for a majority of the value stems from. Other aspects of Bitcoin that are really, really useful is that it's censorship resistant. Nobody can prevent you from sending Bitcoin. It's neutral. So it's kind of like the internet in a lot of ways, where nobody's really in charge of the internet. It's just a global tool. And you can also secure it in very interesting ways. So Unchained, when we first started, we actually did, the founders really thought that maybe it wasn't just going to be Bitcoin. It might be Bitcoin plus a few other cryptocurrencies, or maybe hundreds of thousands of other cryptocurrencies. And so Unchained actually supported Ethereum early on in its life for Bitcoin collateralized or crypto collateralized loans at the time. But we've always tried to build our products and services using the native properties of these different protocols of Bitcoin. So we built our entire product suite on top of Bitcoin multi-signature, which is a type of address that is controlled by multiple keys. So if you have a hardware wallet or a mobile app, for example, those wallets are typically controlled by one key. With multi-sig, you build a Bitcoin wallet that has multiple keys. In our case, it's two of three. So three total keys, any two of which are needed in order to move the Bitcoin out of the vault. So when we first started, we built our Bitcoin collateralized loan product on top of multi-sig. And then we introduced Ethereum collateralized loans, but there's a problem with Ethereum. It didn't have multi-sig native to the protocol. So the founders and the engineering team had to write a multi-signature smart contract for Ethereum, And this was during the time when Ethereum just kept changing. Every few months, there was a massively breaking backwards incompatible change. Unchained was trying to run an Ethereum node. We were trying to do it the right way, really were. And what we found is that we were investing 70% of our engineering resources to something that was only like 10% of our client base. And really, most people who were controlling those other cryptocurrencies didn't really care about this level of security that we were able to provide with Bitcoin. And so we dropped it early on. I think this was like 2019. And ever since then, we've had the focus on just Bitcoin. And this has been a massive, massive advantage for us. We actually just recently published a video about our core values as a company. This was, of course, formed over the last few years, but the number one core value is Bitcoin is our common purpose. So we believe that Bitcoin has the best chance of becoming the global reserve currency, and we want to help people who are securing Bitcoin for many, many years. We want to help long-term Bitcoin savers secure, manage, grow their Bitcoin wealth. And after dropping ETH early on, we very soon after realized that that was the right move. And we have no plans to add any support for any other cryptocurrencies because Bitcoin is just the most valuable one. It's the most important cryptocurrency there is.
Yeah, definitely. And I think even if you don't say like the other ones are scams or they're useless or something like that, like there's Bitcoin and it's so different to anything else. So like we should even, like I try to do it, we should even like just separate it and not even compare it at all, because they're like so separate and so different from each other. But of course, like it's listed on CoinMarketCap with all the other cryptos. Like it gets in one bucket. When you get to a regular bank who has crypto services, they also have like Bitcoin, Ethereum in the crypto category. So it's like a hard thing to break. But it's important that especially we as Bitcoin-only folks, no matter what we're doing, if we have in a company, podcast, whatever we are doing in the space, always making the differentiation between Bitcoin and all others, because I see a lot of comments also from people that are like, oh, I love your content, but I also love Ripple, I also love Ethereum, I also love Cardano. Like even you normal crypto people that are interested in Bitcoin only content because they also have a Bitcoin stake. So like I'm trying to get this ethos into everyone that it's Bitcoin only, and like slowly plant the seeds in the heads that Bitcoin is the big thing and the other ones is like, yeah, I don't know what it is.
There's really a philosophical difference, I think, between Bitcoiners and then I'm going to lump these people together, but crypto supporters and then also just fiat currency supporters. I think crypto and fiat currency are very, very similar in a lot of ways. So the way I think about it is Bitcoin's disruption is that it solved the problem of creating digital scarcity. Now, historically, anything that has been digital has not been scarce, right? Pictures, you can copy and paste pictures. NFTs, you can copy and paste NFTs. It's the same thing with all other cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is the one that solved the problem. You can't print more than 21 million Bitcoin. All the other cryptocurrencies are proof that creating things that are digital and creating copies of things that are digital is trivial. Most of the cryptocurrencies are very small changes to Bitcoin with like a couple adjustments, and they're not credible in terms of their monetary properties. So when I think about these different cohorts of people, a Bitcoiner is somebody who believes that nobody should be able to print money. Central banks and people who support fiat currencies believe that only a small number of people should be able to print money. Crypto enthusiasts think that everybody should be able to print money. So there's a very kind of big divide, I think, philosophically and ideologically among these three parties. Bitcoiners, nobody should be able to print money. Crypto people, everybody should be able to print money. Central bankers, only we should be able to print money.
100%. And which also leads me like, for me, it's the fiat and crypto guys, it's like really similar for me. It's like the crypto people want to build the thing that's already existing in fiat, but just on blockchain. Like they kind of concentrate, like, let's put everything on a blockchain. And it's, it just doesn't make sense for me, because there's an Oracle problem. There's like, you have to have an central authority that gets it on the blockchain at the first place. Then the blockchains are not decentralized. Actually, they are just inefficient in the way of saving it. Like, there's so many problems that I don't even want to get into it. But maybe let's before I want to really get also into it. Why is Bitcoin so decentralized, and why can it enforce this 21 million cap? I also saw on YouTube that you made a small presentation on that. But before we get into this, where do you see Bitcoin dominance going? Like, we are now at like 50-60% or something like that. If you exclude, there's like a different metrics. If you exclude the stable coins, because they're not actually crypto, they're like more like to the fiat, then we are more like at 70% dominance of Bitcoin. Where do you see Bitcoin dominance going in the next like long term, like 20 years or something like that? Do you see crypto still being around, or like Bitcoin really dominating with all the things going on, with like 80-90% maybe even?
I've been very surprised at how long crypto generally has stuck around, and I think it's because people view crypto as more of like a gambling or day trading or speculative asset. So I hesitate to make a specific prediction, but what I will say is that the Bitcoin dominance is kind of a faulty, not kind of, it's a very faulty metric. Bitcoin is by far the most dominant. It's the most liquid. It's global. It's extremely decentralized. All of the other crypto tokens, they have liquidity problems, right? They might appear to be worth a lot or have a large market cap, but if you were to try to extract that that value out of those networks, they would collapse. And we've seen that historically, constantly in crypto. I mean, look at FTX and FTT. FTX, their balance sheet, I think, was like 40 to 60% their own token. And when there was a run on that token, it turns out the actual value of the token was almost worthless. Again, it's very easy to fake those numbers. So when I think about over the long term, yeah, I think in reality, Bitcoin is probably like 80 to 90%, if not higher. And you can just look at the metrics of these different companies and how much of their business is based on Bitcoin. Coinbase, all these exchanges, like most of their business is Bitcoin, even though they list every single crypto token under the sun.
That's why I also think it's really interesting that there are so many Bitcoin-only exchanges and services coming up. And this is like, when you look back just like 4 or 5 years ago, there are not that many completely Bitcoin-only player and educators. Now there are so many podcasts, there are services, there are Bitcoin exchanges, Bitcoin-only exchanges. They're really, really cool, and I like the whole place is evolving with that. Do you also like see we talked before a little bit about, you think that Bitcoin will be the global reserve asset? I frame it differently, but I think we end up at the same kind of thought. I say Bitcoin will be the base layer of everything. Like, it's the future base layer of our financial system. That means it's the global reserve asset. And I think that Bitcoin will be half of everything, like 50% of every human interaction, because of every human interaction, 50% of that is money. And if Bitcoin is that money, everything is in there. Then there are like a lot of great topics on top of that, because then we give a great store of value back to humanity, which people can save in. This will make houses affordable. This will drive prices down. This will bring this deflationary system that we have naturally actually occurring, because we don't inflate the money supply. what do you think of that? Like, what does Bitcoin do in general for prices and the future of the economic system?
Money is the most basic form of human communication. Even kind of lower on the civilization stack than spoken language. You can do business with somebody without speaking their language at all, maybe some hand gestures, right? But money is a token of value. It's communicating, hey, you have that thing over there. I would like to trade this money for that thing. We're both better off. So it's really a fundamental tool for human civilization. And until Bitcoin, that tool has just been, it's suffered from lots of different problems. Gold suffers from being physical. You can't zip gold from the US to China, from Texas. I'm here in Austin, Texas. Can't send it to Chengdu. It's also just very difficult to protect. It centralizes, right? You need to hire a team to protect gold. You can't just, you know, have a pile of gold in your house. And so it's these drawbacks that have caused gold overall to morph into this fiat currency system, which solves the physicality problem and the ease of transaction problem. It mostly solves the ease of transaction problem. But what it loses was gold scarcity. So Bitcoin fixes both of those problems. It is ultimately scarce, and you can send it anywhere in the world permissionlessly. And as such, it allows us to do business with people who culturally we couldn't be more different. You know, I can use Bitcoin to hire somebody from across the world to perform a task, build a website. And so, yeah, it's an absolutely critical tool for human civilization. And until we have had Bitcoin, like, it's been kind of a lie. Somebody at the root of all of society is able to unilaterally just sneakily steal value from people through inflation. So this causes huge problems. Housing gets unaffordable. Wealth inequality increases over time, and it actually gets more severe the more you try to use that old system to solve it. The only way, in my view, to really solve the housing, healthcare, affordability, inequality problem is to make everyone equal at the very, very base layer of civilization with the money. Make everyone equal. Nobody can print money. There's only 21 million, and lots of good outcomes will come from that.
Yeah, 100%. I love how you look at it. I think this is like when you are a long term in Bitcoin, you will see it like that. And it's always fascinating to see how Bitcoin actually achieved that. And this is where you touched on with the presentation, I think January or something like that was a presentation on YouTube or something like that I saw. How does Bitcoin actually enforces that rule, like that we don't have limited supply, that we don't, like, the supply is actually limited? And is there any way that you could imagine that at some point in the future we can break this 21 million thing? Is there any way, like, you could think of, like, okay, when this happens, this could be interesting, where we, like, double the supply or something like that?
What I like about Bitcoin is it's very voluntary. You get to choose to opt into it. And so that presentation I gave, I just wanted to give a very simple rundown of how Bitcoin enforces its fixed supply of 21 million in about 15 minutes. This is a topic that I would say requires significantly more than 15 minutes of time to study, but I'll do my best at running through my thoughts here. So going back to the very beginning, Bitcoin is valuable primarily because of its fixed supply of 21 million. It's valuable because nobody can print it. And so when you're buying Bitcoin or acquiring Bitcoin in any form or fashion, mining it, you know, earning Bitcoin through podcasting, whatever, you are choosing that monetary policy. And it could be an active choice or a subconscious choice. Most people, you know, realistically get into Bitcoin because they see the value going up and they want to just save in that to increase their purchasing power. But again, the root reason that that's happening is because it has a fixed supply. So when you acquire Bitcoin, you're knowingly or unknowingly opting into that monetary policy. And then there's a bunch of different things that you individually can do to help to enforce that monetary policy. You can run the software, a full node. You can download it from bitcoin.org, and it tracks all of the transactions throughout the history of Bitcoin and confirms that that supply hasn't been adjusted. And once you're running that software, you then are essentially like a decentralized banker of Bitcoin, because you have the entire transaction history on your computer, and you can see your balance, and you can see that the supply has never changed. And then if someone else tries to change the supply, you get to choose. You get to say, no, I don't think I'm going to join you. I'll cut you off from the network. Or you could switch out your software and run the new software. So what's really cool about Bitcoin is it becomes, in some ways, an individual choice. Are you going to let someone else change the supply? You can, but then you have to trust that a majority or almost all other people move over to that new network. I personally have made the decision that Bitcoin has a fixed supply of 21 million. So if somebody tries to change the supply, and there's a history of this happening in 2017, a small group of people who were unhappy with how Bitcoin was evolving wanted to change a small component of Bitcoin, totally unrelated to the supply, but that change was backwards incompatible. So what happened is Bitcoin kept running, and this other cryptocurrency kind of forked off. It became its own thing, but it had the same shared history. And that other cryptocurrency is called Bitcoin Cash. So whether they were knowingly increasing the supply or printing a new money, or whether they were ideologically really just trying to make that one little change, doesn't really matter. What happened was that a vast, vast majority of Bitcoiners who had control of their Bitcoin during that time, once that second currency split off, they sold the second currency for more Bitcoin. And you can see this in the price chart. If you look at Bitcoin Cash and its history, especially measured in Bitcoin, you can see that early on it had quite a bit of value, and then it very quickly went to almost zero in Bitcoin terms. So this, in my opinion, is really the crux of why Bitcoin will never inflate beyond 21 million. And it's because there will be people during that time who actively trade whatever copy of Bitcoin is created.
And I think this is the most important part for everybody that does not understand how decentralized Bitcoin actually is. Study 2017, the block size wars. Like, yeah. Really, really study it, and also look at the free market outcome of that and what people actually did. And it was also fascinating. I was not around at that time, so I'm only like able to talk about it because I heard from other people. But it, as I saw it, there were like the huge part of the industry actually on the Bitcoin Cash side, and only the users that opted out and then shifted the whole industry back to the Bitcoin protocol. Fascinating for me to see. Like, I can just like encourage everybody that did not study this till now, study the block size wars. It's really important for Bitcoin's future.
I was lucky or unlucky enough to live through it, and it was a very wild period for Bitcoin because, to your point, some of the largest companies in Bitcoin really thought that this new copy of Bitcoin was the right direction, and so they put their weight behind supporting it. But for companies that were supporting it, they can't control exactly what their users are doing, right? And at the time that the copy was made, by granting their users access to both forms of cryptocurrency, the users could then make a choice. They could hold on to both of them. They could sell one of them for, you know, any other cryptocurrency or dollars or euro or whatever. And you just see that the market immediately crushed the copy, just very quickly. It almost instantly went down. But there were a few other things that were very interesting about that time period. Users were demanding an upgrade to Bitcoin that was backwards compatible, so it wouldn't create a copy. And a lot of the core developers during that time were unsure how to deliver that feature to people. The core developers, the people who were working on Bitcoin on the software, were actually somewhat of a roadblock to this feature that users really wanted. So a developer under another kind of anonymous name created a copy of the Bitcoin software with the new upgrade, and a bunch of users started running that software. Again, it's permissionless money, right? And because enough users started running that software, it became almost like a black hole. It started pulling more and more of the weight over into the new version of Bitcoin. Again, that was still backwards compatible, so it was still the same monetary policy, the same protocol, but it just had a new feature that was really requested. So Bitcoin not only routed around the largest miners, companies in the space during that time, it also kind of routed around the Bitcoin core developers. And I think that's like a lesser discussed aspect of this. It was really healthy, in my opinion. So people always say, like, well, there's only a few people who maintain the Bitcoin code. What happens if they're captured or co-opted? This time period was another example of, well, you can very easily create a copy of that software and avoid the entire kind of Bitcoin core development process and continue the network without breaking it.
I never really worried about the core developers because, as you said, they are really not in power. Like every other every other software project, developers are actually quite empowered. They can put something in there and they are developing it, but they are just like, they're making the code, but they don't make the decisions like that, if we can say it like that. But what I worried in the beginning, and this actually changed now, that over 70% at one point of the miners were in China. Now with the Exodus, it's probably way less, like 10% maybe, speculating. I mean, China wanted zero, but I think there's still a lot of mining going on in China. Do you see it still as some sort of problem that mining becomes more of a specialized operation with like only really big facilities can mine? Is there any risks or problems that you foresee?
I've always thought of mining as actually not even its own industry. It's just part of energy production. Bitcoin mining is a very, very critical tool for any sort of energy generation. The reason being that it's always going to buy your electricity. Now, it's only going to buy your cheapest electricity, so it doesn't compete with manufacturing, with heating people's homes, so on. But you always have a tool that will buy your cheapest electricity. The other thing about Bitcoin mining that makes it extremely powerful for energy production is that you can flip a switch and turn it off and flip a switch and turn it on. There's no ramp up or ramp down period. And so this makes it an extremely valuable flexible load tool. So let's just give an example. If you have a wind farm, right? You can't control when the wind is blowing. You can't control how people are going to demand your wind energy. You can just install the windmill and then generate the energy and then transfer it and maybe store some of it in batteries. But I did some research into this, and you know, this is now a few years out of date, but when I was doing research, about 18% of the time, people with wind farms were shutting off production. They were just not generating any more energy. This is a massive opportunity cost. They could, you know, when the wind is blowing, if people aren't demanding all of the electricity, you could essentially vent the electricity into Bitcoin. You can monetize it immediately. So this makes renewable energy production a lot more affordable, like more profitable, essentially, because you will always have somebody to buy energy regardless of when you're generating it. And it's also just something that doesn't compete with energy that people need. So it's a super powerful tool for energy production. Now, I think today, the way that we kind of look at Bitcoin mining is, yeah, there's these massive, you know, public companies and smaller private companies that are focused exclusively on energy or on Bitcoin mining. It's like its own little industry. But I think if you talk to them, a lot of them realize that I need to get an edge on energy production, because if you can produce energy for cheaper, then you can mine Bitcoin for cheaper.
If you are listening to this podcast, you might be wondering what is actually the setup look like of Robin, or how can I improve my Bitcoin setup? And there's two things. You have to buy Bitcoin from the right source and you have to store Bitcoin the right way. Let's focus on the first thing. How to buy Bitcoin. It's simple. Have a Bitcoin only exchange. Don't deal with the shitcoin exchanges. Don't deal with an exchange that has an own token or something like that. Be on a Bitcoin only exchange. I use 21 Bitcoin. 21 Bitcoin is for me the best partner for that. And now, where do you store Bitcoin? Bitcoin should be stored on a hardware wallet, on a self-custody solution where you yourself hold your keys, and it should be a cold wallet. So that's my simple solutions. That's a Bitbox. You just put your Bitcoin on there, back up your seed phrase, and you are better than 95% of all Bitcoin hodlers. If you have more than 1,000 euros in Bitcoin, it's an absolutely must have. One last thing before we get back to the video. I'm really passionate about meeting other Bitcoiners. And there's an amazing opportunity in the middle of Europe in June, the Bitcoin Prague Conference. It's the best and biggest Bitcoin-only conference in whole of Europe. For all Americans, please visit Europe and visit this place in June. For all Europeans, it's a must-go anyways. You are so close to the Bitcoin Prague conference, you basically have to come. I will do interviews there, and I would love to meet you all there. Use code Robin for all my sponsors to get discounts, and use the links down in the description. And it's interesting to see. I also had with Lisa, I always say Huff, but I think in America it's like Huss or something like spoken. But she talked about on my podcast that energy producers are in this unique position where they should or can monetize on molecules, energy molecules that they actually waste right now. They're paying to a load of wasted energy that they actually could make money off, and that it's a really big possibilities for all the energy producers, especially those who have excess energy, that they actually just can make a money.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the timing of the amount of energy you're producing and the demand for energy, right? If it's super windy, you know, in the middle of the day and nobody's home, you're probably generating way too much electricity, and you can still monetize that, which will help you to build out more wind. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, in the U.S., there's even companies that are starting to monetize totally wasted gas. So at landfills in the US, they emit methane. Now, it's just right now being vented into the atmosphere. What you can do is actually burn that methane and power a Bitcoin miner and earn more money. So you would actually be earning more money not venting this dangerous gas into the atmosphere. When you have these economic incentives aligned like this, really interesting things start happening. And you start seeing very major improvements in, you know, the environment and energy efficiency and so on. So a lot of people, I think at first glance, look at Bitcoin and they're like, oh, it's a big waste of energy, uses a lot of energy. But the really important question to ask is specifically, what energy does it use? And then if you think about it from the other side of the equation, from the energy producer's standpoint, it's actually an incredibly valuable tool to help you generate energy cheaper for people.
Yeah, it changes the incentives, which also leads me to my next topic, which is, I had both sides of the aisle already on my podcast, because for me, Bitcoin is a fundamental revolution that changes a lot. But there's also the crowd that says, in the end of the day, it's just money. And if people are still lazy, like, it doesn't change human nature. It just gives another layer to it. But then also other people say, no, it changes the incentives of people. And I think Charlie Munger says, like, then give me your five biggest incentives and I will show you what you will do. And it can change a lot, I think, in society. How do you see it? Like, and when there's another aspect also, like, I think you also talked about on a podcast with that, the HODL waves, like when we see that in Bitcoin, actually people are holding onto their coins for a long period of time, and the, like, any stock like any company that is publicly listed is really envy of that, because people are like trading the stock and not holding on for long and stuff like that. How do you see Bitcoin is changing society in a way, or changing behaviors in a way long term? Are you also of the opinion that it's just money and it changes a lot for those who see it early, but long term society level, it changes not a lot?
I think Bitcoin changes almost everything. I think it doesn't necessarily change human behavior overall, but it does incentivize cooperation and capital accumulation and collaboration. It makes that a lot more economically worth it than fiat currency. I think in fiat currency, there's an incentive to just get as close to the money printer as you possibly can by any means necessary, and then you benefit. And that unfortunately makes people cut corners, lie, you know, misconstrue the truth, like produce lower quality items. And I think when we fix that like genesis inequality, which is that some people can print money but you can't print money, when we fix that so that nobody can print money, I think the positive externalities of that are pretty unimaginable. Like, I can't even really visualize them. I just think that it brings a sense of truth to things that are right now a pretty big lie, if that makes any sense. So it's like brings truth at a very fundamental level. Like, you know that the value that you're generating and providing to other people is going to be yours, and you can use that in the future to purchase things of value from other people. I think it incentivizes really big things in the world.
Yeah, definitely. Incentives are like basically everything. Like if you're incentivized to do something, you will do it in general. Like if you're incentivized to do it and you can do it, you will do it. Like, there is no question about it. And if Bitcoin changes the incentives to save, because it depreciates over time, and all of a sudden everybody saves in Bitcoin, not in like euro or in dollar or something like that, where incentive is like get rid of it because it gets rid of it on its own. And then we're getting Bitcoin, where it's like, oh, if I wait like 2 months longer and don't get the newest iPhone, or wait like a year longer before I upgrade my car or something like that, then I get it for cheaper. This completely changes society. And this is like also what I try to bring in the conversation of environment, because this is also a good thing for our environment, like a really indirectly thing, but mm-hmm. one that is really good also for that. Which is also,
yeah, I mean, incentivizing saving is probably the most important environmental impact that we could possibly make. Right now, you are incentivized by the money just turning into paper. You're incentivized to consume unnecessarily. You're investing in things that you don't care about. You're purchasing, you know, additional houses because it's a way to escape this inflation. With Bitcoin, it makes any large purchase, you think not just twice about it, you think four or five times about it, and then you wait, and then you think a little bit more, and then finally you spend some Bitcoin to purchase, you know, a new car, for example. But it makes the purchase decision very painful, and that's actually a very good thing. It means that people have to compete way harder to earn your money. It means that you're less likely to spend it on partying, and it means that the sooner that you get to work and the sooner that you start delivering value to people, the sooner you can retire, because your money will not just, you know, increase in value over time, but or not just store value over time, it'll increase in value over time. So it's funny, I think there are people in Bitcoin where, you know, their most lucrative job was probably making sandwiches 10 years ago and saving in Bitcoin. Right. And right now they could be some sort of exec at a company, and they won't be able to earn as much Bitcoin as they did when they were driving Uber and saving Bitcoin 10 years ago.
Definitely. And it's, I adopted Bitcoin like 4 years ago, right around that time. And ever since then, I only increased my stack. Like every month, I never took out of money from my stack. And I've been all in since 3 years. And every month, I'm trying to keep more income than I have expenses. And I always try to keep stacking on. I don't know when and what age this will ever change or if it ever changes, but but I like
hasn't for me yet.
how old?
Well, this is now my 10th year in Bitcoin, and I still every day try to earn more Bitcoin because you don't stop. Bitcoin's money, and you don't stop earning money. You don't just say like, oh, I guess I have enough money, I'll just stop. It's like, no, every day you want to be earning more money. You brought up another topic that I wanted to touch on briefly, which is this concept of the HODL waves and our behavior that we're describing right now of like saving for the long run and not spending frivolously. You can see that this is how the Bitcoin market behaves because Bitcoin is a public database. Earlier, I was saying you can run the software at home. You have all of the data of all the transactions. And now what you can do is you can start visualizing that data. And the HODL waves, I think, are the most important visualization of the blockchain, of the Bitcoin blockchain. And it shows how much Bitcoin has been just sitting for how long. And it shows different bands and different waves, because you can tell like when the fiat price runs up, people who have been holding for a longer time start selling. And then those coins become kind of fresh new coins and they appear at the bottom of the chart. It's a really fascinating chart and definitely worth studying. You can find it at unchained.com/HODLwaves. But it's the truth, right? You're just seeing the true behavior of people who are treating Bitcoin as money. And overwhelmingly, people hold it as a savings vehicle for years. I think when you're new to Bitcoin, you might think, oh, this is really risky, it's so volatile, it's a trading asset. And it is, it's a trading asset, it's very volatile. But if you want to really do well with Bitcoin and increase your purchasing power, the majority of people just hold on to it for years. And it's something like, if you hold on to Bitcoin for at least 3 or 4 years, you're in fiat profit. It's preserved value or significantly increased in value.
Yeah, definitely. And it's I always try to debate those things because then people are coming like, oh, but this 2 years, this up from Bitcoin. And I'm like, 2 years? Like everything under 5 years is for me not even worth looking at because it's such a short amount of time. Like I consider 5 years extremely short term, and medium term is for me like 10 years. And long term, we're talking like 50 years. Granted, there is no 50 years in Bitcoin. So like for me, like Bitcoin in itself has no long-term history. It has like a really medium short-term history because it's just a short thing there. But if you look at any amount longer than 5 years, and if you're looking at lower time horizons, then I encourage you to look at longer time horizons because stretch out your view a little bit. It's good for your life. And then you don't trade Bitcoin once you get that.
In the U.S., some of the fastest growing Bitcoin products are Bitcoin held in retirement accounts. So there's a couple different types of retirement accounts in the U.S. And you know, you could have a employer sponsored retirement account, a 401k, or an individual retirement account, an IRA, and you get certain tax advantages based on how you form your retirement account. You can either pay taxes on your money up front and put it into the account where then it can grow tax-free, or you can deduct cash from your paycheck. Don't pay tax on it now, and then you have to pay taxes on it later. So there's these retirement accounts, and you can now put Bitcoin into those retirement accounts. And so those are, again, like across many different companies, some of the fastest growing Bitcoin products are these Bitcoin IRAs because it's just such a good long-term asset. And when you move something into an IRA, typically, I mean, some people, again, trade their IRAs. I'm not one of those people. But when you move Bitcoin into a retirement account, typically you're not even thinking about taking it out. You just set it and forget it for years. And so that's why I think Bitcoin is such a potent retirement tool.
Is I'm not from America, so I heard a lot of IRA and 401k and all the stuff. But is it like you have to buy a Bitcoin ETF for that, or can you still self custody stuff when you have an IRA?
There are three primary, maybe four, three to four primary ways that you can get Bitcoin in an IRA. Now, because of the ETFs, that's probably the easiest way. So if you have an account with like a major traditional company in the US, like a Fidelity, Schwab, you know, so on, you can move some of your retirement funds into the ETFs. The problem there is there's so many different layers of counterparty risk. And if the last 15 years of Bitcoin have taught us anything, it's you need to be really careful with who you trust in Bitcoin. The other ways that you can get it are like direct Bitcoin holdings through like IRA companies. And then you can also control keys to real Bitcoin in an IRA account. So there's a bunch of different ways that you can get some Bitcoin. I think in that second version where you just have like direct access to Bitcoin, again, you have that custody problem. Like, where is it being custodied? Have they done a good job securing the Bitcoin? Can you get Bitcoin out or only dollars? You know, with the ETFs, you can only get dollars out. With the ones that have custody kind of in direct exposure to Bitcoin, sometimes you can get Bitcoin out, sometimes it's dollars only. And then when you control the keys, of course, you have Bitcoin.
That's really cool. And Unchained has a really cool service also with like custody solutions, which is the topic I want to touch on also, because it's really important that people, first of all, understand that self-custody is the way. But there are different levels that, like, I think if you have 100 to 1,000 euros or dollars in Bitcoin, it's a different story when you have like 500,000 euros or dollars in Bitcoin. Like, you need different setups for different things, because if you have 200 euros, a hardware wallet is a kind of big expense. Like, you pay like 100 euros for a hardware wallet and you only have 200 euros in Bitcoin. So like, it does not really make sense in that regard, other than if you plan to do more with that. Where do you see those like ranges, and what do you usually recommend for people getting into that, and especially with like a custody solution, where a collaborate custody, I think it's called, like how, collaborative when custody. Do you recommend that?
There are many different custody options in Bitcoin. Historically, the greatest number of people use a custodian. And basically, I guess even at a higher level, all Bitcoin is controlled by keys. And keys can live on little tiny devices. They can live on your phone. They can live with a custodian. But at the end of the day, all, you know, 19 point whatever, 6 million Bitcoin that are available are controlled by keys. Now, you can choose to hold your keys, or you can pay somebody to hold keys on your behalf. The greatest number of users use custodians today. That's where the custodians control the keys on your behalf. The problem, and people do that because it's like, oh, I don't want to learn how to use keys. It's too complicated, too scary. The problem is that you have so many different layers of risk there. What's primarily protecting your Bitcoin in that model isn't really how the custodian is controlling the keys. Like, that's very important. But most people lose their Bitcoin from just getting their accounts hacked. So their username, their password, two-factor authentication. Because if somebody can get into your custodian account, they have the Bitcoin, essentially. They can coerce the company to send Bitcoin to their address. That's how most people lose their Bitcoin, far and away. The greatest number of Bitcoin, millions and millions of Bitcoin, are secured in self-custody, where individuals control keys. It's a smaller number of individuals, but a vast majority of the Bitcoin that's out there. And even within self-custody, there's a bunch of different flavors. There's single signature, where you have one key controlling your Bitcoin. And then there's multi-signature, where you have multiple keys that are used to kind of create like a safety deposit box or a vault, and then multiple keys are used to spend the Bitcoin. Single signature is really good as a first step to start learning about how to hold the keys. You can test it out with smaller amounts. Multi-signature, I think, is the best for your long-term wealth. The Bitcoin you're thinking about holding for years. Because in a multi-signature address, and again, with Unchained, for example, we use 2 of 3. So the Bitcoin address is created from 3 keys. Unchained holds one. Our clients hold 2. 2 out of 3 keys are needed to spend the Bitcoin. In that model, there's no single item there that you can lose that would cause you to lose Bitcoin. We've all read those stories of, you know, the stories of the guy who lost his hard drive in a dump that has like, you know, $100 million or probably even more than that now worth of Bitcoin. The reason that they lost their Bitcoin is because there was a single item that was securing all their Bitcoin, that hard drive in that example. We've also heard of people who forget the PIN on their device, get locked out of their Bitcoin. Again, that's a problem because there's just one device securing it. If you have multi-sig and multiple keys, and especially multi-sig with a partner, which is collaborative custody, you have a lot of redundancy. You can make a pretty critical mistake. You make multiple critical mistakes without losing any amount of Bitcoin. Now, you know, if you don't want to learn, you know, multi-sig or keys or all that, some people will then just choose multiple custodians. All right, I'll spread out my pots. I'll have a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. The problem is if any one of those runs into an issue, you've lost money. Again, compare that to multi-sig. You can lose multiple items without losing any Bitcoin. So it's that single kind of critical point of failure that multi-sig solves for, which is why Unchained built an entire financial services suite on top of that custody model. It's what's helped us to grow to securing over 90,000 Bitcoin.
Yeah, I love it. I think we are still in an early stage and we need so many companies, solutions, hardware wallets, service providers that just like try to innovate, try to make it better. And everything that is Bitcoin only and gets to self-custody, I promote it. Like I want Bitcoin in self-custody. I have those friends that have everything in Bitcoin and that they have it at exchange. And I'm like, there are solutions out there. Like if you want to have a service, there are solutions out there for you that you can use the service. If you want to do it yourself, I can show you. I will be there for you. Like we can make a seminar for a whole day. Here there's a hardware wallet. Try it out at least with a little bit. So I'm really passionate about self-custody, taking your own keys. But it's a cool insight. I never heard that before, that the vast majority of users have custodians, but the vast majority of purchasing power actually have it in self-custody, which makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Like I think on exchanges, there's like 3 to 4 million Bitcoin. And then there's about 3 to 4 million Bitcoin lost. And so that means there's 11 to 12 million Bitcoin that are secured in self-custody. It's a massive amount of Bitcoin. So yeah, I think when Unchained was being founded, we were, you know, our founders looked at the HODL waves and they're like, wow, people are holding Bitcoin for the long run. And then they were considering this. It's the same story. Even back in 2016, 2017, when we were founded, the largest number of users were with custodians, but the most Bitcoin was in self-custody. And same thing is true today. And so that's why they founded the company with this idea of collaborative custody, where clients can still control keys, but Unchained is there as a partner to guide you through the whole process. You can, you know, if you run into any issues, you can use the Unchained key, and then we're able to offer all those different financial services like the retirement accounts and trading and loans and so on.
Really cool. For the end routine in our podcast, we have an end routine where the previous guest is asking a question for the next guest, actually, without knowing who the next guest is. So it's like a question not tailored to the next question. A guest, and the previous guest was Roman from El Salvador, from the Bitcoin Beach, an early guy there. And he had actually 2 questions. The first one was a quick one. When are you visiting El Salvador?
I was just looking at flights this week. So I don't have a date, but I absolutely must visit. I actually was getting really excited. I saw on Twitter this guy who was walking through a mansion in El Salvador. He was showing off the different rooms and how cool it was. And I was comparing that to housing prices here in Austin. And I was like, that's actually pretty reasonable. So yes, it's very high on my list of places to visit. I don't have a specific date yet. I'll almost certainly make it down for a conference within the next year or two.
Yeah, I will be there if like 80% sure at the adopting Bitcoin in November, I think it is. So that I think will be, because I also have not been there, but I definitely want to visit. And his second question, also this last question of the podcast, is like kind of always with you, but what are you doing for Bitcoin? What is your value that you add to Bitcoin? And then like in for humanity, because you added for Bitcoin?
First of all, great questions. Both of them are awesome. Yeah, I mean, I've worked professionally in Bitcoin since 2017 and primarily focused on putting private keys into as many hands as possible. So even before I worked at Unchained, I was, you know, consulting with other multi-sig tools and mobile wallets. And I really think that my greatest contribution is promoting this concept of self-custody. And I've been doing it now. You know, I think this is my fifth year at Unchained. I also have personally onboarded hundreds of individuals and businesses to controlling keys, like literally set up hardware wallets and built multi-sig vaults. So reflecting on my time, I think that's my biggest contribution, is getting as many private keys out there into the world as possible. We released a statistic recently in a Bitcoin magazine interview with our CEO, Joe Kelly. The 90,000 Bitcoin plus that we're helping to secure on our platform is secured with over 12,000 keys. Pretty incredible. Like if you think about that 12,000 keys, 90,000 Bitcoin, compared to a Coinbase, for example, 2 million Bitcoin, how many keys? 5? 3? 10? I don't know.
1?
It could be 1. It literally could be 1. We don't know. That's kind of my biggest contribution.
Yeah, it's also fascinating to see that everybody's custodian with from the Bitcoin ETFs with Coinbase. Almost everybody, like Fidelity, has self-custody, some others, but the majority has Coinbase, which makes a big honeypot. Like, let's see if someone gets into the honeypot. I don't hope so, but yeah, could be something.
Tour de Meester had a great quote about this recently, which is Bitcoin is one of the least risky assets that you can own if you're controlling the keys and doing it well. And the Bitcoin ETFs are probably the riskiest ETFs that have ever existed, simply because of the centralization problem. There's one custodian per 10 of them. What happens if that custodian runs into issues? I wouldn't personally be able to sleep at night knowing that significant wealth was centralized in that form or fashion, but I probably spent a little bit too much time working in Bitcoin with keys, so I might be a different perspective.
Definitely. So thank you for being on. Thank you for taking the time, Phil. Before I let you go, where can people find you? Like, where can people reach out to you if they have questions for you? Where can people reach you the best way?
You can find me on Twitter at Phil_Geiger. You can email me at phil@unchained.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn. So yeah, just connect with me. My DMs on Twitter are open, so you're welcome to shoot me a message. I try to respond to all of them that aren't blatant, you know, spam accounts or whatever. And yeah, definitely reach out to us at Unchained if you think that we can help you improve the security of your Bitcoin and take control of your keys.
Perfect. I will also drop your Twitter link in the descriptions. Except on Twitter, because there's your tag anyways. I'm looking forward to that. Thank you for being on. It was a pleasure.
Robin, I had a great time. Thank you.